Welcome to Real GM Radio. I'm Daniel Rue, your host, and so happy to have you with us for this episode. My guest is Dan Feldman of Dunked On Prime and the Daily Dunks, and I really enjoyed the conversation. We start out talking about the playoff pictures in both conferences, the sheer volume of things that still have to be resolved, and what excites us, what teams and situations are interesting. Then we move into a conversation that goes in a couple other directions, including a little bit of a reflection on the big trades that happened in the summer of 2022, meaning the Donovan Mitchell, DeJounte Murray, and Rudy Gobert deals. Now that we're basically two seasons in on that, we talk a little bit about the draft and how players improve and adapt and everything else like that. Really good conversation brought to you by Prize Picks. Download the Prize Picks app today and use the code CLNS for a first deposit match up to $100. Conversation with Dan runs over an hour. Lots of really interesting threads in this that I think you all will enjoy. And here it comes. Thank you so much for coming on.
Thanks for having me.
I was going to ask you what story you're most interested in, and we will get to that. I will say, for me, it's the Minnesota Timberwolves ownership situation, but because that is unclear and because John Krasinski was too busy to come on, we're probably not going to spend as much time talking about that, but I will note at the outset that that's it. So let's say, with the possible but not mandatory exclusion of the Minnesota Timberwolves ownership situation, what is most interesting to you right now in the league?
Well, if we are excluding that, because I do think that is just so juicy and so interesting, it's awesome that we have all these different playoff races or postseason races for the play-in, for seeding, that these games mean so much. You know, that's fun.
Yeah, along those lines, something that, you know, still most teams have 9-8 games left that I'm really excited about is that it's still too early for anybody to jockey for a position. So, for example, like, I brought this up with the questions about the top of the West. Like, who you let's say the most important thing for some teams is going to be avoiding the Denver Nuggets. We don't know what seed the Denver Nuggets are going to be. So you can't, right now, you can't do those kinds of dances. And there are so many teams that are so close to each other at different phases of the standings in both conferences that other than the Celtics, we just don't know.
I think it was the Ringer. Apologies if it was someone else had a stat that there's only one playoff matchup that is, this was as of a couple days ago, that was more than 50% likely to happen, and that was Clippers-Pelicans. And it's like, well, it's a little bit cheating because you don't know if that's going to be the 4-5. Well, it'd be the 4-5 most likely, but you don't know who's the 4, who's the 5, so I could see some extra wiggle room there. But it is interesting how few are set.
I was rooting for a Clippers loss to the Magic last night just to increase the chaos on that side of it. Because then it would have been, I think the Mavs, the Pels, and the Clippers would have all been within one loss of each other. There still is a chance to have a run. And part of what I've been excited about with that kind of middle pack in the West is the idea that somebody could come out of it. And I didn't, you know, still don't know whether that's going to be as the six or something else. And have a lot of momentum. Like, you could have a team come out of the bottom because you had that pack, and it was like that somebody was going to break out of it. Right now, it looks like Dallas is the most likely. But the idea that a team could be the six and feel good about it, and I at that point thought that it was going to probably be Minnesota who they play. At this point, I'm less confident in that after Friday's win over the Denver Nuggets. But that the idea that you could do that, I mean, of course, we saw that also last year. Well, the Warriors situation was a little different.
Yeah, I mean, to me, what's fascinating in the West is a lot of these teams that are in play-in position, they have really good veteran players that you have seen excel in the playoffs. Maybe they're too old now. Maybe they're waiting to dial it up. I would be real nervous as the Timberwolves or Thunder if I have to play any of the Suns, Lakers, or Warriors. That does not seem like a just reward for earning a high seed.
Not necessarily. And I mean, there's also the idea that depending on what seeds each of those teams end up with, you're going to be either facing a team that played well enough to get the six, or you're going to be playing a team that won at least one, maybe two play-in games.
Right. I don't know if we've seen enough from the play-in to have a sense of how much momentum from it matters. I haven't sensed that in the time
either.
It's been in so far.
If Miami last year killed anything, it might have been that.
Yeah, right. I mean, barely squeaking by Chicago did not give you the faith that they were going to have a lot of momentum.
Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt your train of thought if you were trying to go a different place.
No, all good.
Well, and I mean, I also watched a fair amount of that wild Knicks Spurs game yesterday and was thinking about that part of the Eastern Conference where you have, you know, I think the Bucks preliminarily, and recording this on Saturday. We'll see how I feel about it a couple days from now. I think the Bucks are going to be able to hold on to the two. They have a tough last five, but they have a pretty easy schedule before that. And if you take that as a given, which you shouldn't, but is something close to it, then the 3-4-5 in the East is really compelling, because those teams have a fair amount to play for, though you can make an argument, depending on which version of the Knicks you think we're going to see in the playoffs, that the three might be the most dangerous of those spots, depending on who gets the six.
You're saying if Philadelphia gets the six.
Or Miami.
Yeah, I guess that's true. Or Miami. I don't know. I'm going to say something real foolish. The Heat just don't look as dangerous as they did last year. And some of this is hindsight looking back on last year. And I didn't realize the extent, oh, wow, they're really underperforming their shooting. And if they even go back to, you know, what you'd average expect for them is shooting, they're going to be much better. And then they ended up exceeding that. So that explains a lot of the swing. You know, okay, that makes sense to me looking back. I didn't necessarily see all that coming, but I see it. Now I'm just having trouble seeing why this is such a dangerous team, other than their experience now, playoff experience, and Jimmy Butler always turns it up. And that's good enough some years. It's not good enough other years. We tend to focus on these runs the Heat have made, but maybe ignore the years where they flamed out early. And I don't know. I don't see this Heat team as just another dangerous team because they were dangerous last year. I don't think that's quite convincing enough. I think they're a solid team, and it wouldn't be the most shocking thing, but I just don't put what happened last year so much on this year's team.
That is very fair, especially when you consider the personnel differences between last year's team and this year's team, and the passage of time in certain extent. But part of what I think about, and this is, you know, the sample that you get bias, you can think about it that way, is Nate and I broadcast a week ago. We did that Cavs Heat game where the Heat just demolished them, like just completely like took the Cavs out of everything they wanted to do. That was a Mitchell-less game, but you're like, oh yeah, they still do have all of these, like they can play lineups that don't really have as many weak points defensively. They also can, like, Spoelstra to me is the best playoff coach in the league. You have all of these, you basically, it's like it's a weak version of the theory, but the theory is still there. And the reason why that matters more to me with the Heat is because there are teams that they could potentially face who I'm not sold on. And so the idea is you lean on the flaws that you were already freaking out about and go like, oh, this is a team that, and I mean, of course, one of the teams they could play is Cleveland, that could tie in with that. And like, I don't think this series is going to happen, but a Heat Magic series would be gross.
I'm rooting for Heat Celtics. I think that'd be a lot of fun. I think the Celtics are the best team in basketball. I don't know if they're going to win the championship, but I do think they're the best team this year. But just the mental challenge of facing the Heat, I think would be real enjoyable.
I think if I have to put myself in, if I can will one first round series into existence, it's, even though it's not going to be the right year for it, it's still Sixers Bucks, just because the whole Doc element and everything else. It's like, I want us to get a full strength version of that series, and I would love for that. If I could choose anything, it would be that series next year. But that's not the way we play this game. And I mean, the amount of drama that would be in all that, and it would be a lot of fun. But yeah, I mean, with the middle of the East, kind of like, especially now in some ways that, for at least for the time being, like Indiana's in this too. Like, I like Indiana. I think they're an interesting team. But having that group that also in part might be separated from the Celtics, and just like that, I just don't believe in any of them. It's kind of like I'm hoping for somebody that I have faith in to be there just because it'll be interesting. But it could be a really good opportunity for the Cavs and the Magic and some of the teams in this space to do something that makes me feel more positive.
Yeah, I mean, look at the Knicks last year, right? We didn't go into the playoffs thinking so highly of them. And then the way they demolished Cleveland, it completely changed perception of the franchise. There's definitely those opportunities that'll be there this year.
And it could be the Knicks again. Like,
absolutely.
Very possibly. And there are so many threads. I mean, I'm thinking about OG right now, but in the East of what's like, it's the thing that you never want to have to put the caveat you never want to put on, which is like, well, what version of these teams are we getting? And I mean, like, that world beater version of the Knicks, like, it requires a certain collection of their players to be available. And I don't know if that's going to be the case. I sincerely hope it's going to be the case.
Very true. I mean, it would be a bummer in a year year that looks like there's a lot of parody. The whole point of parody is you get more compelling series if some of these don't turn out because somebody is hurt.
True, and like that, Nate and I did a whole segment of a pod recently about like the teams that aren't right, and there is time for that to happen, and especially in some ways for a team like the Knicks, where they're probably going to avoid the play-in, and so they'll get that week off that could be good for them. And I mean, we haven't, to my knowledge, you're on this stuff more than I am, we haven't gotten any news on Randall either, right?
Yeah, I haven't seen anything.
And we're in that murky area where it's like they're probably trying to see if he can rehab it, and if he, yeah. And so in some ways, no news is good news because that means that he hasn't had surgery yet. But we also haven't heard like, oh, there's progress or all these type of things.
I'm a little surprised you aren't making the argument that if Randall's out, that's not the worst thing for the Knicks.
I was thinking it. I wasn't saying it. But for me, OG is the bigger yeah. argument there. And I mean, like the way I don't believe that the Knicks are the team that you might have that record, but it was like 15-3 or something wild like that when OG played.
I don't know off the top of my head, but they were playing well. They had a great groove going. And I still see shades of that. I mean, this is a team that plays confidently, that has an identity, and that I think has transcended who's in and out of the lineup.
Speaking of teams that have transcended who is in and out of the lineup, I mean, it did get shifted a little bit by the losses to the Hawks, but like the Celtics have occupied such a bizarre space within like the NBA over the last month plus, where it's like They're playing very few games where they have like all of their best guys, and some of that is probably excessive caution, not excessive, significant caution. And yet, with that, you know, cleaning the glass plus 17.6 net rating, number one offense in the league by roughly a mile and a half. They're at a 128.9 since Valentine's Day. And I don't really know how to process that.
They remind me of the 2015 Warriors, who were just the best team in the league all year. And they were playoff tested some. I think these Celtics are playoff tested more, but they were just better than everybody. And it got to the finals in 2015 where they matched up with LeBron, who was more familiar. And I think a lot of people pick Cleveland just based on LeBron. And I don't know. I have a hard time picking against the best team. And that's who these Celtics remind me of.
It's also a little bit bizarre because it wasn't there a theory of the case that that was Denver last year? Like that Denver was the team that was just, but I think that was because of the Jokic minutes. Like that was the no Jokic, non-Jokic stuff. Because their overall numbers last year weren't as good. But it was like that their best version was better than anybody else's.
Yeah, so I do a stat every year of looking at how a team performs just when guys in their playoff rotation or who I project to be in their playoff rotation are on the court. And Denver was first. But it was also a year where there was less separation than usual. Usually there's one or two teams that like when you adjust for this and you get rid of all their garbage time minutes, you get rid of minutes of all the minutes the guys they traded away because they said these guys aren't helping us. You get rid of all, usually it's negative minutes. And so somebody, one or two teams usually shoots way up in their net rating in these minutes with playoff rotations players only on the court. And the Nuggets were first, just not by a ton. I'm curious when I do it this year, exactly how I was going to shake out. I think this year, it's to me, just eyeballing it, there's going to be more teams that shoot up a ton. I think the Celtics will fare very well in this. I think the Bucks could fare pretty well. The Clippers, like I think there are a lot of teams that have been excellent with their top players, and maybe the Suns would be another one where you trim their depth, you shorten their rotations, and you're going to get a really good version of this team. As you and Nate might say, their fastball is very strong.
The Clippers are a really good example of that. I mean, I think last I saw when their three best players were on the floor together, they were at like a plus 11. But because they have so few other iterations that are viable, and they're I brought up the theory last week on Dunked On that, and that actually came from a Mo Tequila conversation on Real GM Radio, that their overall depth, their depth of quality and their quality of depth are so weak that they just can't withstand any absences whatsoever. But when they have their guys, they can be really dangerous, and they've gotten some nice wins.
And I think that's correct, but it's weird to me that this team has ended up with such little depth, because essentially Steve Ballmer has decided to pay for depth. They're paying this huge luxury tax bill, and it's not just to have these top three guys. A lot of it was to make trades for depth that other teams can't afford, and it's weird how it's worked out. Obviously, they sacrificed some of that depth just in terms of matching salary for James Harden. I don't think a lot of that was so much about the players. I think it was just trying to match his big number. But regardless, I think that cut into it. But it's still weird to me that this team is so functionally not deep.
And some of those guys also like have injury stuff, either present or future, and all that. And so that makes it a little bit more complicated. Yeah, I mean, like Nate and I were talking about that a little bit with like how important Norm Powell and Russell Westbrook are to the Clippers. And that's a challenge for Ty Lue to navigate. And the other wild thing about this is that you brought up Ballmer's willingness to spend. It's like that none of the like, well, I guess there'd be one exception, but like the second rounders they bought, that like none of those guys have turned into players, and like they're not faring particularly well on the minimum market and all those type of things. And
but it's not just the minimum market. Like Amir Coffey to me is an example where they signed him for a few million dollars a year when I think almost every other team, when they're already, first of all, very few teams would ever get that expensive. But if they were ever in a brief period where they were willing to be expensive, they'd say, look, Amir Coffey's a minimum player. And yeah, it might take us a few million to keep him because we're not going to be able to give him the minutes. That's how we're going to make up for it. But we'll just let him go. Like, whatever. It's not that important. The Clippers are like, oh, yeah, we'll pay Amir Coffey. And what are they getting at? Like, those types of decisions, you make enough of those, you're not just in the minimum market like the Suns were last offseason. The Clippers have been above the minimum market in a lot of ways because of their spending, and I just don't see the difference as much as you'd think.
That's true. It's a good way of putting it, and I have this theory that, and that's going to get even stronger in the next couple of years, that that life in the second apron is going to get even tougher than I previously had thought that it was going to be, just because they keep on cutting out the team building tools. Yep. And they're, you know, like at now, you know, now it's that you can't, you know, add a signing for more than the minimum. And then the trade matching rules are about to get a lot thornier. And then if you want to count the more punitive luxury tax that's coming into play, then there's that too. And if
I don't,
yeah, I don't either, because that's not it's not a team building tool. And like the frozen picks and stuff, maybe Keith Smith's idea on this is really interesting, that the frozen picks may actually end up benefiting those teams in the long term, not in the short term, but in the long term, because it'll prevent them from trading picks that end up becoming kind of good. But
I mean, it's going to make them more balanced, right? It's going to be harder to go all in.
Yes.
In the present, and it's going to be harder to fall too far in the future. But for teams that want to decide that for themselves, it's going to take away the option. I definitely believe before this CBA that basically the more you spent, the better, right? It wasn't always going to work out, but if you spent more, you gave yourself more opportunities, more chances. That's, I think, a lot of what the Clippers have done. Like I was just saying, I was surprised it hasn't worked out better, but they're just giving themselves better chances. Under this CBA, that's no longer true because of all those team building mechanisms that you just mentioned. Now it's tricky, even if you're willing to pay. And to me, if I'm a fan of a team, it's not my money. I'm not trying to save the owner money. I'm not applauding an owner saving money. I'm not saying, oh, well, it's prudent not to go in the luxury tax this year because you're not a contender and it's not worth it. For me, if I'm a fan, it's always worth it to spend more to be better because it's not my money. Now, under this CBA, it's different. If you're spending more, it's not necessarily the best way to make your team better. It might hurt you.
That is a potentially useful way of thinking about it. And honestly, even though it's not what I wanted, it does appear to be what the ownership side wanted out of the CBA.
It's closer to a hard cap than I ever thought the players would accept. Now, that said, I do think the players got a ton of concessions in the CBA too, and I think overall came out ahead. But they, I think, pretty close came to a hard cap by a different name. Let me ask you a question. How many times do you think a team is going to have a frozen pick where it's hits those rules where it goes to the back of the first round?
Very rarely.
I think zero. I don't think a team is ever going to accept that, which means for those years, it really is a hard cap. That if nobody's willing to accept that, I guess that's not a hard cap if you have the choice. But
it is a very not porous cap.
Yeah,
it is
the hardest really, soft cap.
It is like that really, really hard candy that is technically breakable, but it's, it, yeah, that Maybe there will be one, but it is going to be rare. And I mean,
think about how drastic of a penalty that is, because it's so many years out once you'd meet it. And I think teams, even look, Matt Ishbia came in with the Suns, was talking about, we're never going to lose. You know, our goal is to contend every year. The Warriors talk the same way. There are some teams that delude themselves into thinking there aren't downturns, as if that's how it works, if there's not natural cycles built into the system. But I think even they know that we just can't risk having a pick that's so many years out that, be obviously, I think self-evidently, if they're even considering it, they're in an era of contention at the moment, which means there's almost nowhere to go but down, which means the way the natural cycle works, you're probably going to be down in the years when that pick would be, where you're going to say, we can even take a chance of something that could look like a top five, even top 10 pick, all of a sudden go to the very end of the first round. I just don't think there'll be any appetite for that one bit.
It would have to be a circumstance where a team was probably coming off of a championship in the second to last year, like the year before the trigger year, and thought that they were, that shedding the salary it would need would take them out of high-end contention. Like,
see, I don't think that is the scenario, because they already won the championship. Like, it's nice to win two championships, but there's a big difference between zero and one, and it takes a lot of pressure off. Like, the Nuggets would love to win a championship this year. They're trying really hard to win a championship this year. They're spending, so like, they're trying really hard. But there's not the pressure on them to do it, because they've already done it.
So you're saying the scenario is like a team that makes the finals, loses in a heart-wrenching series, hasn't won a title, at least in this iteration, and this is like their last good shot? Like, so they just like...
Yeah, the scenario is like the Bucks, if Giannis didn't sign the extension, mm-hmm. and you can pick either time, where it's like, okay, we got to do this to secure the guy that we believe can keep us really good when this frozen pick is going to be an issue, otherwise he's going to leave it. Like, that's the one where you got to think about it, but it's so far out, and contracts are so short now, players are so capable of moving, especially stars can demand trades. I just don't think teams can feel certain enough that they know where they're going to be in the short term or the long term, right? You don't know that it's going to pay off immediately, and you don't know where you're going to be when the pick would actually transfer from wherever it is to the end of the first round.
It's a great point, and plenty more to discuss, but first a message from Prize Picks. Prize Picks is the largest daily fantasy sports platform in North America, the easiest and most exciting way to play DFS. It's just you against the numbers. Instead of battling thousands of other players, including pros and sharks, you pick more than or less than on 2-6 player stat projections and watch the winnings roll in. If you want to play alongside some of Prize Picks' favorite players like Meek Mill and Sugar Sean O'Malley, you can find community plays under the promo tabs of the app to view entries from some of the biggest names in the Prize Picks community every week. And I love that Prize Picks even offers injury insurance so that your entries stay in play even if one of your players gets injured. For basketball games, if you have a player who leaves the game in the first half and doesn't return for the second, that player projection won't count against you, and the rest of your entry stays live. I think that's really cool. And that ties in with my favorite thing about Prize Picks, that it is player-specific. So if there is a matchup you like, or in some ways, even you call it juicier, a matchup you don't like for a specific player, then you just pick more than or less than, and you can work with that, whether it's a high-profile player or a lower-profile player. If you see something you like, you can check it out. And this is a great time to try out Prize Picks, because if you download their app today and use the code CLNS, you get a first deposit match up to $100. Again, download the Prize Picks app today and use the code CLNS for a first deposit match up to $100. Pick more, pick less. It's that easy at Prize Picks. It will also be informed by something that I've been interested in that's coming down the pike, which is these big trades for non-superstars. So like the DeJounte Murray deal and the Rudy Gobert deal. And then we can make an argument about the Donovan Mitchell deal, because I think, there was more excitement about him potentially than the others. But those trades were sacrificing future flexibility and resources for present gains. And obviously there was a brutal first year for Minnesota, but now they're fantastic. As we're recording this, they're tied for the top in the West. And the Hawks are obviously not, and then the Cavs are their own thing. And what I've been wondering about is, so we've already seen somewhat of a response of like, there haven't been comparable trades to that since then. But what I've been waiting on is when, like, for example, the Hawks picks start to come home to roost, does that inform how other general managers managers see making a version of that trade. Now, incidentally, one of the players who somebody could go after is DeJounte Murray, though the asset price is probably not going to be the same. And so that idea of, oh, like the Hawks basically gave up control of three straight drafts for a non-All-Star. And not like the Jrue Holiday, not the guy who like pushed them into championship contention or anything like that. And Gobert, you know, I would love to see Minnesota have a fantastic year and kind of give those teams some ammunition potentially. But I think there's going to be a clawback on that. And it would be fascinating for Rudy Gobert to be the centerpiece of it, because he is one of the biggest reasons why teams don't sell first round picks anymore.
Yeah, that is a great point. We can say conceptually, hey, this trade was worth it, it wasn't worth it, here's what we should learn from it. But actually seeing the downsides, seeing the down years, seeing a team experience those, I do think goes a long way in a way that a theoretical discussion can. A lot of it's going to depend on how good those teams are. The Nets already did this. The Nets traded all those picks for Garnett and Paul Pierce, and then didn't get as much initial success as they wanted, and then had some lean years. But they also did a good job of clawing back, of drafting smart, of developing players. And it wasn't as bad as it seemed like it would be. The Nets, to their credit, did a good job of managing a horrendous asset situation and turning their team credible and getting into playoff contention far quicker than I certainly thought they would. And so that's what it's going to depend a lot on. If the Timberwolves lose in the first round this year, and then all of a sudden Rudy Gobert is old and the team is like barely making the playoffs and Anthony Edwards is unhappy, then yeah, I think that's exactly how it'll go, that there'll be a lesson learned. But if, let's just say Anthony Edwards is all that he is the superstar, that he's the best player in the NBA. And you go, man, they could have been even better if they hadn't done this Rudy Gobert trade when he was young and not ready. But if they're really good, if they're competing, it's not going to be as strong a feeling.
It'll be more like the people like me, and I think to a lesser extent you, who complained about the Anthony Davis stuff, where that didn't like it didn't destroy their franchise, but it did make them less good. That was, and what I mean by that is the like Omer Asik and the like the trades they did that short circuited a little bit, and to an extent getting Jrue, though Jrue ended up of course being a good player. And it also, there being multiple samples for this will be relevant. So like you have the Wolves, the Cavs, and the Hawks that basically did this same type of thing around the same time. So I would say Minnesota has the rosiest present, the rosiest maybe future, depending on how their financial cataclysm and all the ownership and everything else. And then you're going to get the Donovan Mitchell part of it. I know that Dan Gilbert is more optimistic that Donovan Mitchell is going to stay there. I don't know Mitchell's heart well enough to have a indication on that, though I generally believe that I will not believe that a player is choosing a place that he has never chosen until he does. And then you have the Hawks. And the Hawks are, they're the danger one for me. I brought up before that the Hawks, their future assets that they owe to the Spurs, I think, are some of the juiciest picks that exist right now that are owned by other teams. And the reason, part of the reason why, is because they might, like, I mean, obviously they've had less Trae Young than they wanted, and being 34 and 39 as we record this podcast isn't fantastic. But actually, I think they're 34 and 40, I think, because they lost the Bucks tonight. And that is unfortunate. But I also don't know whether, like, I don't think they're going to be as bad unless they do it deliberately, which they won't. I don't think they're going to be as bad as those Nets teams were. And, like, that spooked teams for a few years, but it didn't spook front offices for that long.
Yeah, well, the Nets traded for guys in their late 30s, mid to late 30s. That's how you get that bad. The Hawks also traded of those three teams, three players, I guess, of Mitchell, Gobert, and DeJounte Murray. The Hawks traded for the worst player. Now, they also probably gave up the fewest assets. And not only is he the worst player, he's probably the worst fitting player on his new team. And I say that, you know, who would have thought that that'd be the case after all the fit concerns about Rudy Gobert and Karl Anthony Towns? But the Timberwolves have made that work all right enough. Mitchell's problem, well, I mean, Mitchell has his fit issues with Darius Garland. Like, none of these were perfect fits, but Murray was the worst player and the worst fit, I think, from what we see now.
And also, they've had, there's some context in it, but they've also had the weakest overall results. I mean, so this year, the last year, the Hawks finished 500 and lost in the first round. And then this year, they are five games, I think they're six now, under 500. And they'll be fortunate if they lose in the first round.
Yeah, that'd be a great season for them if they make the playoffs. And I think we throw the Clippers in here too, by the way, for the Paul George trade. You know, some of those picks are still coming. And obviously, I think he's a higher caliber player. And I know your point was trading for, you know, these like sub all stars or borderline all stars, not somebody like Paul George, who's an all star pretty much every year,
and who helped you secure another all star.
Right, right. I think that trade made a lot of sense for the Clippers, but they definitely have not had the results that anybody expected when they made that trade, and a lot of the downsides are still coming.
Me chief among them. I mean, year to year, the the Lucy pulling the football thing, and this year, and I think this would be so perfect. This year, I'm out on the Clippers, and so this would be the perfect year for them to actually to make some real noise and be like, of course.
But I think they got a chance.
They do. They absolutely do have a chance. And I. Part of it, I dwelled on this a little bit with Mo, and it's hard because we're talking about in the abstract, though you are a great person to discuss this with, which is how these teams, because this feels at this point like a really variable, malleable postseason, where it's like, you know, depending on the matchups, depending on everything else. And it isn't the free agency offseason. It isn't one of those like, oh, there isn't a LeBron out there or anything like that. But there are franchises in varying stripes who have really, and players who have really big decisions to make. And you brought up contracts are shorter now. Things move more quickly. And how everyone involved, how all the decision makers, the veto players interpret these results is going to be so important. And part of what makes our job fun and stressful, but fun, and I think about the mock-off season with this and everything else, is all of the entities involved in this. Like I brought up decision makers and veto players. It's like players, general managers, owners aren't necessarily rational on these things. They don't have to be. Like you can either be irrationally confident, you can be downtrodden, you can be whatever you're going to be. But for various players, for various franchises, these results, as random and chaotic as they might be, will really, really matter.
Absolutely. I mean, the Hawks are a great example, right? They have that run to the Eastern Conference Finals. And to me, from the outside, I said, that's awesome. They had a really cool run. They should appreciate that. Trae Young played awesome. He went on the road into Madison Square Garden, had those big moments. Like, if I were the Hawks, I'd just say, that was really enjoyable. They said, we're close. We're a move away. And I never saw that. And you know, that one was one where they probably regret operating that way. But also, you can make the argument, too, that if you choose to be aggressive, what's the harm? I do think there's a lot of risk in saying, we're not close, we're not going to make the move. And then you are, and you're not ready, you're not good enough. So that can go either way. I cherry picked one where I think I ended up being more right than the team, but it can go either way.
I'll throw out two more that are going to be, we're going to get tests on more soon, and then they will inform a third team. So on the being aggressive, Cleveland. And what I mean by Cleveland is the idea, first of all, like how is this year going to go? Obviously, last year was a very dispiriting loss in the postseason. But how is this season going to go? And we will get significant clarity on the Donovan Mitchell situation over the next few months. Whatever that clarity is, there will be clarity that will come from that. And they might end up being, I'm not saying they will be, but they may end up being the other piece of information on these like trades that happen, which is you can recoup value potentially on the back end. Now, if Donovan Mitchell stays, I'm completely fine with that. If Donovan Mitchell goes, I'm completely fine with that. But I do think that if he refuses to sign an extension, which is his want, if that is his want, then they'll get some significant stuff there. And it'll probably be a team that's lining something up. I don't think they're getting anything near what they gave up. But
you
they
sure?
also,
I mean, they might.
I think
that's a little high with him coming closer to the end of his contract, but I don't think it's impossible.
It's not impossible. And the combination and that trade involved fewer, like there wasn't a Walker Kessler in that trade.
Well, there was a Lowry Marketing.
Oh, there was a Lowry. That's true.
Right. And
that's a pretty big omission on my part.
When I say get back, I'm counting Lowry Marketing as what we thought he was at the time, not what he turned out to be.
Not the most improved player. Yeah.
They cannot get a player better than Donovan Mitchell plus picks back.
yeah,
but they can get what we potentially. And that's why I like the trade for them so much. I thought, great, you get this good player. You guys are ready to win now. He's going to help you be better. And if it doesn't go well and you have to trade him, you'll at least come close enough, I thought, to justify us.
And that was what made me happiest with their deal of the three, was the idea, especially because he was younger and he had established level of quality. And And the idea that you also would have that decision window, which to me always was the summer of 2024, where you will, if you don't get him on an extension, to me, you pretty much have to trade him.
Well, let me throw something at you, though.
Okay.
So I think based on the current salary cap projections, he is going to be eligible for an extension that is worth his max. It is possible, though, that if the salary cap rises as high as possible, then his extension would not, his largest allowable extension based on his current salary, would not be the max salaries he could get in free agency. And that's when you're in a pickle, where he says, look, I think I want to stay, but I think I'm worth the max, so I'm just going to play it out, because then you're taking a major risk.
I don't think you're in a pickle. I think you have to move him. It's too risky.
But it's a different equation than if you know your extension is the most he can get anyway, and he says no, then you know, okay, well, we're not going to have any advantage. Like, he doesn't want to be here. Like, then he's basically telling you that. But if he's in a situation where the money could be higher by waiting till free agency,
you know this math better than I do, but we're probably talking about like a few million.
It's not a huge difference. It's going to depend where, look at, you'll know this summer where this year's cap is. So it is possible that this year, depending on where the cap is set this summer for next season, then we'll know it. It's not
because it can only go up a max of 10%.
Right. And so if it goes up enough less this year, then you can know that his largest long extension will be the max. It's not a huge difference in terms of, like, when we're talking 200 some million dollars. I don't know. Offhand, I think it's like $7 million is the largest possible difference. But also $7 million is a lot of money. And if you feel good about where you are, I also would say Donovan Mitchell's probably not quite the caliber of player. He's close, but not quite the caliber of player that can just say, I know I can get the max in free agency. I know I can wait a year, no matter how hurt I get. If he doesn't get hurt, he'll get the max. But what if he gets hurt? Then I'm not sure he'd get the full max. He probably would, but, like, I just don't think he can be certain.
It's not Giannis, you know, potentially refusing to extend the extension he did, where it's like he could tear his Achilles the next day, and or like the day before free agency, to be like, yeah, doesn't matter, still Giannis.
Yep.
And I mean, you could argue that is an important difference. And I mean, we haven't seen Donovan Mitchell evaluate risk, really, because that's, you know, I brought up the, like, choosing a team that's like all that sort of stuff, but then there's also the, like, you know, the decisions you can make there. And so, but to me, it's like, if the difference is relatively close and he says no, and you're right to bring up the potential phrasing that gets used in those conversations, much of which may not end up being public, depending on how everything goes. But to me, it's the idea of that if it's that tight, then the answer is, it might not be no, but it's close enough to no that you treat it as a no, and then you work from there. And the other reason why, if I'm Cleveland, I would go that direction is because there is a way to stay good. I mean, generally speaking, when you trade a good player, you're doing it for picks and other stuff. But maybe they could reroute those, or they could do something else. And they, like, I mean, Mitchell being gone sucks if that happens. But they would still have Garland, they would still have Allen, they would still have Evan Mobley potentially in the fold. And if you wanted to make a larger reimagining of their roster, you absolutely could.
Yeah, and that goes back to why I like this Mitchell trade so much for them in the first place, was I think it makes him better right now, and that's worth something. And then if he's gone, you trade him, you recoup some picks. And then those other guys are still so young, you'd have time to figure out what's next. And maybe even by then, maybe that trio is just good enough on their own. I don't necessarily think that's the case where that's how it's going to be, but it's at least in the realm of possibility. But then you'd have whatever assets you recoup. And so that's, I think Cleveland is in a very good spot.
So
they built their team.
The other team I wanted to invoke in terms of the, like, have the resources and didn't do something, and I think, and they still could, is New Orleans. And New Orleans they have an exciting team. They're doing well in the Western Conference. They do still have resources. You know, they have this deferral right with the Lakers pick. They have a couple other assets, though most of those are swaps. I mean, the Bucks 27 will be interesting, but it's actually kind of weird to trade right now. And for New Orleans, and Oklahoma City is the further out parallel to this, which is, do you kind of keep playing it out, draft a Dyson Daniels, draft a Trey Murphy, or is this year the impetus for, we have a lot of good players, but we want to do something bigger? And bigger could mean a lot of things for them, but as somebody who's not the biggest fan of the like whole being this bed greater than the sum of the Pelicans parts, that is the type of thing that would be compelling.
Yeah, I mean, what's tricky is they're kind of a weird team, weird style of play. It's hard to tell exactly what they should get, let alone what's available that's going to fit with their team. So yeah, sure. And in the abstract, and say, yeah, it makes sense potentially for them to push in, but for who, for what?
And I mean, we don't know exactly what the negotiations were a year ago or 8 months or whatever it was ago, but the potential of like the idea of like an Ingram trade or a Zion trade, because there were some rumors about that with the draft because some teams had high picks and didn't necessarily want them and all of that. But it's like the Pelicans could also run into the problem that they were to an extent on the other side of in the CJ McCollum trade, which is they obviously want to stay good and they're probably doing this to improve. And that means you need another team who both wants what you have and has what you want. And that's going to be really tough for them because whatever you identify as their need, I've brought up for many years, like a floor spacing center who actually can play defense would be a very good thing for them to have. You could argue that having another guy who's better with the ball in his hands could be useful, even if Zion does a lot of that lifting, and Ingram really deserves credit for his improvement as a playmaker. But so the idea of we need to get better, but then it's also like, okay, well, who is this player and how do we get that player? It's actually a situation. The other one that I could think of is like I've ripped Memphis a lot over the years for not doing some of the things they didn't do, but they also like couldn't really put their stuff together to get that kind of guy.
Yeah, all those stretch bigs who can also protect the rim all around the league for New Orleans to pick.
All five of them.
Yeah, that's the
Yeah,
the
I mean, problem. why couldn't they get the number one pick and draft Victor Wembanyama? Like, that, obviously, that was the move.
Right. And then as far as a better ball handler, sure, but then you're probably lowering the value of McCollum, Ingram, and Zion. And at a certain level, the best teams do just get more talented players and those stars kind of figure out the roles. Sometimes they do, sometimes they don't. That's the difference of whether you win a championship or not, but you got to try. And I get that, but I just think it's too many players where you're lowering all their values.
That's true. And again, like there could be a perfect fit that would justify that sacrifice. But is that player, not only does that player exist, but is that player gettable right, for the resources that you have, both in terms of matching salary and players and everything else? Like it is a very real problem. I want to talk briefly about one of my favorite stories that's going on in the league right now, which is the Houston Rockets. And I wrote them off when Alper and Şengün went down, especially because they didn't even have a backup center. So how are they going to do it with a starting center? And they've been really fun. They've had some chaotic, weird games during the stretch. Like a big part of their success has been that they had a pretty soft schedule and have done well with it. But Jalen Green is putting the finishing touches on the best month of his career, which is extremely encouraging. And there are reasons for that in terms of both. Jared Dubin did a great video on this, in terms of him driving into traffic less because there is less traffic and having better balance on his jump shot. But this version of the Rockets has just been really fun, and they've made that, I don't know if it's a battle for the 10 seed, but like they've made the end of this season far more compelling than I fear.
And they're really embracing their identity. They were a team all year that played hard, played a little scrappy. They're playing even scrappier lately. They're really leaning into it. They know who they are. I am surprised also, because Şengün was very good for them. He was their best player. And to lose him and to pick it up, I think a lot of it, like you said, is having a little bit of a softer schedule. But they're taking advantage of it. That's nothing to take away from them. I don't know. They're winning games. It just doesn't feel like they should. It doesn't seem like this team should be quite down enough. A lot of it is Jalen Green, who you mentioned. I think people would rather hear what you think about Jalen Green. I think everybody in Houston wanted a mea culpa from you on Jalen Green, even though you were right, even though he wasn't doing this before. But he's putting it together. It's been awesome to see.
He is. And I think parts of what he's doing are real, and parts of it are a little bit more, you know, the best part of your sample and situational. And so the stat that Dubin had that knocked
knocked me out was apparently Second Spectrum has this, which means that if I had Second Spectrum access, I would just be living in this kind of space. Jalen Green only went straight up and down on, I believe it was 21% of his jump shots the entire season until the end of February. That number in March is like 37%. And he's shooting, as you would guess, a lot better on the straight up and down shots than he is on the jumping side to side, front to back, whatever it's going to be. And so better balance on his jump shot. That is something that I can't say it's because Alperen Şengün's not on the floor, obviously. But he has a nasty habit of driving into traffic and identifying that poorly. And that is a lot better right now because they're playing Jabari Smith Jr. primarily at center. And so the decisions he's making now are not reflective of what I expected to be moving forward, even though he has improved and deserves credit for that improvement. So Green has been a better version of himself. And I think that significant parts of that are real. And it's always, this is the turn that I have some trouble with sometimes, which is when I'm high on a guy and I turn on them, I usually turn really hard. That is just the way that it is for me. The guy who I always think about with that is Eric Gordon when he was a college prospect, where I thought he was amazing. And then I'm like, oh, he's just not that good and everything else like that. It takes me a long time to build back that trust. But with Green, he'll be a fun test case for this because there was a reason I was so high on him as a draft prospect. So it's kind of fighting. It's kind of like fighting my impulses against each other. It's like there's a reason you like him. There's a reason you turned on him. But the beauty is we're going to build out the sample. We're going to get more. And Green has the talent. Part of what pissed me off so much with him is that he always had the talent to be better than he's been. And that is still true. Completely true. And we're seeing it now.
The thing that fans of a specific team often don't want to admit or don't see, yeah, I really like Jalen Green as a draft prospect too. He's still very young. I don't think I got quite as down on him his future as you did, even if we saw his present similarly. But I do think what fans often miss is the guys who turn into stars, they usually show more early. They usually figure out more than he did earlier than he did. Not always. They're definitely late bloomers, and his talent level gives him an opportunity, always did, his athleticism, all of that package gave him an opportunity. But that's true of a lot of guys. He's not the first guy to come in with a ton of athleticism and talent and some eye-popping things, and you want to give him patience. Most of those guys in that group show more earlier if they're going to become a star.
The last time I recall, and there have been others, that I got into a long-standing argument with a fan base about a guy like this was Andrew Wiggins. And Wiggins proved to be a fascinating test case in like five different ways on this idea. Because a part of what Wolves fans at the time, or Wiggins stands if you want to see those as different groups, which in some ways they are, were saying was like, oh, look at all these physical tools. Like he, and it's, Wiggins is the one who led me to the should be, will be, is framing that I don't talk about a lot on the pod, but I think about a lot myself, which is like, there is a difference between like, will be is so much like, if somebody isn't something, will be is actually really hard. Like people think of that as automatic and it's not. And with Wiggins, that was a lot of that was on the defensive end, where it's like, oh, he has these great tools. Like he sometimes it was he is a great defender. It's like, no, he's not. He will be a great defender. Well, could be, should be, something like that. And then with Wiggins, so what happened is eventually a lot of the people who were in his camp ended up agreeing with me, and then we all ended up being wrong temporarily because he put it together and then was a huge part of the Warriors 22 championship. And then he's been worse on both ends of the floor for me this year. And so it's like the idea that there is, and of course this was a long-standing thing. I was lower on Devin Booker for a long time. I've now had him number one in shooting guard rankings for at least the last 2 years, maybe the last three. Is there's an idea, and it's especially true with toolsy shooting guards, honestly, for whatever reason. And Brandon Ingram was another guy like this to an extent, who's not a two, but the idea that progress and stardom is inevitable when it isn't. It really, really, really isn't.
Yeah, I think one thing you can do is go back and look at like how many all NBA players didn't even make an all rookie team. It's very, very few. And and that's not a high bar. Like Jalen Green made an all rookie team. I'm not sure he deserved to. I can't remember or not how I felt about his rookie year coming off. But that's such a low bar, and then some guys don't do it, and people get stuck on their potential. Devin Booker, for me, if we're looking back on him, he was the one. I try and listen to what people say. I try and listen to the arguments they're making, and I just kind of realize, oh, everybody's having two different conversations. Somebody says Devin Booker is not good right now, and then somebody else says, you fool, he's going to be great. And those are two different things.
Yes.
But the thing with Devin Booker was he showed nice progress. Now, he started off a lot rougher overall in how he impacted winning than the people who believed in him most wanted to admit. And so even as he was making this steady progress, these improvements, he still wasn't impacting winning in the way that that you would think with his talent. And that left some doubt of we haven't seen it yet. And obviously he's doing it now. He's one of the best players in the league and continued along that track record. And so that's the nice thing about Jalen Green, right? That is something I often look for is are you progressing? How are you progressing? Are you getting better? And I think we're seeing good signs there.
Another part of the Devin Booker story that I've been so fascinated by, and it's funny because it parallels his now teammate Bradley Beal, is that both of them were players who, like, I watched Beal in college, but like I didn't watch a ton of Booker. It was just in that lull where I didn't have quite as much time. And he was like, he was right at the fringe of where I was doing like draft work back when I stopped doing everyone. And so the idea was like, oh, well, he's definitely going to be like this great dominant 3-point shooter. And then we'll see what else he can do, the in-between game and everything else. And his playmaking has come on so much. And like Beal, he never became the dominant 3-point shooter that we all expected him to be. Like that, the thing that we expected, you know, going back to Kentucky and everything else was going to be like his signature skill. He hasn't done that, but he has become a star in a completely different way, and not in a way that we saw. You know, I'm looking it up right now. Booker had 42 assists his entire college season at Kentucky.
Yeah, 40, he was 40. In such a limited role there.
Yeah, he was. That was a bizarre Kentucky team, by the way.
Yes.
One of the most.
The thing with Booker's three-pointing, I don't know if you've seen the stat. It's gone around a little more lately. It's crazy. Do you know what his career high three-pointers in a game is?
Is it like nine?
Six.
What?
Yeah, it's six. Somehow he cannot make seven in a game. And here's the crazy thing. I'm looking at this right now. His career high every season of his career, six. He's made six in a game every year, but never seven.
This is now going to be something I'm very, very into.
And I've had this on the back burner of some type of research. I don't know exactly how I'd frame it, but try and look at, I don't know, guys who are similar. You know, you're right. He has not turned into the three-point shooter in particular exactly I thought he'd be, but he's still a pretty darn good three-point shooter overall, both by volume and percentage.
Absolutely.
And I was trying to look at maybe I'd do something in who are his peers, right? Look at anybody who makes as many three-pointers as he does or shoots as good a percentage or some combination and see what their game-high three-pointers are. It feels like, yeah, nine feels like, yeah, that'd be kind of low. You'd think maybe he'd made 10, but nine sounds about right, well, I guess. I mean,
and he has a 70-point game and a 62-point game in his ledger.
But has never made more than six threes in a game. It's just, I think it's more random than anything, but it is weird.
That is super weird. It would be very funny if he does it in a playoff game. It's just like, okay, let's get into that. And you're right. And like the other thing that Booker's shooting informs is he is a very good shot maker. You know, like he makes some of those tough twos at a better rate than other guys do and everything else.
He makes tough threes too. Like he takes some tough threes out of necessity. Like I think he is one of the players whose three-point percentage does not say how good of a shooter he is.
That's true. And for as a point of reference, Booker, 40% roughly of his threes are unassisted right now, and that's a lot lower than for a lot of the players who like who have the role that some people thought he could have. I'm not saying some people like they were, I was right and they were wrong. No, I didn't see enough of Booker at Kentucky to say what his role was going to be.
Yeah, I mean, he was, even coming out of college, he was definitely one of the more limited prospects, and he was probably the last one where I didn't give somebody a Kentucky boost, a guard a Kentucky boost, where I didn't say, whatever I think of him, I'm going to bump him up a tier, maybe two, just because he's at Kentucky and better. And my draft boards have been better because I've done that.
Stray note on that general point. I didn't get to go to his Hoop Summit, but I'm trying to think of a player with a bigger margin between what we thought they were going to be when they came out of college and what they were if we separate offense and defense than Towns. Where, like, it, especially because the overall level of quality isn't that different. I mean, I'm sure there were people who thought, like, megastar and everything like that. But the idea back when Hoop Summit and then that year at Kentucky was defensive monster, and if he can put the offensive game together, and now he's so bad defensively that he can't play his position, and he's so good offensively that he has to play, like, he's still a really good player.
Yeah, that's a great one of that model. I guess Wendell Carter Jr. comes to mind a little bit as he was supposed to be far more limited defensively than he's ended up being. The offense is probably closer to what's projected, so it's not quite the flip.
Like, there, Marcus Smart, his role is really different, but when I remember watching him at OK State, I don't remember thinking he was going to be an offensive stud. Like, I thought he played really hard and he was going to, you know, he would be a good pro. But like with Towns, it's just like star on one end, we'll see if the other end works. And it just is completely the opposite.
Yeah. I'm just, it's an interesting category of player. I'm trying to think of who else could fit that. I mean, Markel Fultz, that one might be just a little too unique, where he's supposed to be the shot maker, dynamic offensive player, and is not that at all, but has carved out somewhat of a career by being a more of a hard-nosed defender. Well,
and then a guy who isn't quite that, because he was good on the other end, the NBA reputation, like one of the earliest guys that I did, like for write-ups for Real Jam was Paul George. And Paul George, I loved him at Fresno State. Like, I was a bigger fan of him than most people. The first radio hit I ever did was Indiana talking about how much I loved their draft that year when they drafted PG. I'm trying to remember who they got in the second round. They got a guy in the second round I liked too that year. And he, you know, for me, was athletic, defensive. Let's see what he can do on offense. And then he became a really good offensive player, you know, became a top 10 player in the league in that sort of. But that wasn't the same as the, like, the Towns flip.
How about, I mean, Towns is the best one. I'm not going to beat them. How about Dennis Smith Jr., somebody who's supposed to be this go-to offensive player and then falls out of the league and is sticking because he is a hard-nosed defender. And he looked nothing like that at the beginning.
Yeah. And it's not, and Smith wasn't the same as like Dante Exum, where like I believed in Exum's defense from the beginning. It was just like, does he have enough offensively? And he just became a more exaggerated version of that player, a more limited version, but a more exaggerated version.
This is a fun game.
It is. And it's funny because we've both been doing versions of draft stuff for such a long time. And now I'm kind of wondering what it would take for somebody to do that again. It will happen. It inevitably will. So I think the question I want to end this on with you, and it's kind of fun to do this when we still know so little about where the playoff picture is going to be, is I may end up doing a pod similar to this with Matt Moore, but that'll be closer to the time. What players and teams, I'm not focused on reputation here. I'm focused more on like where things go, like so organizationally and personally. What players and teams do you think have the most on the line over the next 4 months?
Well, that is reputation, right? Because to your point, the decision makers, owners, GMs, all of them together, a lot of it is based on perception, how they're feeling, how the outside is feeling, what they're hearing. I think the perception is separable from that question as I stall to think of an answer.
I'll give you one at the outset, and it's an easy one, but it's still
the Timberwolves.
No, it's the Celtics.
I think it's the Timberwolves. You make your Celtics case.
Because if the Celtics don't do it this year, I mean, it obviously depends on how that doesn't happen. But they've been the best team in the league all year. They're miles and miles ahead of everyone in the East. They have a pretty soft path through the East. Not saying that that is their definition of success. If they don't win the championship, I think that the season is at least some pretty significant flavor of failure. But then they're the most talented team in the league, assuming they make it through, and the reason they lose is not health. In that case, I don't know that ownership Brad Stevens reevaluates it at this point, but you're at least starting to think about it.
See, I'm not. And this is where the perception might come in, because I think there's far too much noise about the Celtics. It's hard to beat the field. I think the Celtics are the best team in the league. Am I picking them over the field? I don't think so. But I'd love to be the best team in the league next year, too. They probably would be. If I'm picking who's going to be the best team next year, it's probably the Celtics. And so you say, okay, you know, it didn't work out this year, and maybe we can learn something from it. But I'd caution against trying to learn too much. I'd just love to be the best team in the regular, you know, when I say the best team, I'm not just saying they're a regular season team. I'm projecting the playoffs too. I think they're the best team in the league. I'd like to be the best team in the league every year. I don't think they have the contractual pressure to not do that, yeah. Like
or,
in terms of
or
where
they're. Dan, could you phrase this as the most likely champion instead of the best regular season team? Because like I think that's also.
Sure. Yeah.
I don't know that I'm going to pick them to win the championship at the start of the playoffs, but arguing them as the most likely champion is completely fair.
That's real similar to what I mean by best team in the league. Like best team in the league is not just about the regular. It's similar to how you guys do when you're ranking players. The regular season counts. The playoffs count. The playoffs probably count more. But it all counts. And I just think that the period, they're the best team in the league. And there's no pressure for them not to return next year as the best team in the league, even if they don't win a championship this year, unless they feel it, unless they hear the noise, unless they want there to be the pressure. But there doesn't have to be. The reason I went with the Timberwolves is because there has to be because of their payroll. This is going to be a luxury tax bill unlike anything they've ever seen. And so it's going to depend on how they do this year, how close they think they are, whether they think that spending is going to be worth it. And then obviously who the owner is also going to be a pretty big wrinkle.
It's a great answer because the history, and you know this better than basically anyone, the history of the luxury tax, especially steep bills, is that you have to have earned it by prior performance. You don't get this unless you have a Ballmer or somebody else like that. You don't see teams, especially in smaller medium markets, who are just like, they're just going in all the way. Now, Denver did pay the tax last year and then won a championship, and then they're paying it again. But they didn't have this gargantuan bill. They weren't looking at what the Wolves are looking at for next year. And so the precedent, the history is a guide. And even if they could get out of it quickly, should they want to or feel the need to after next year, it's historically unlikely for them to go as hard as they would need to keep this team quality at the level it is without some success.
It's the silliest thing. Every owner says, yeah, I'd pay the luxury tax to win a championship. It doesn't work that way. You have to pay it or commit to paying it. Obviously, when you write the check is a different thing, but you have to commit to paying it. You have to build out your payroll before you know whether it's going to result in a championship.
But that's just not the way it works usually.
Yeah.
Which can be really, really, really frustrating. I'm trying to think about who else is high on that list. I mean,
Clippers. I mean, look, as long as Paul George doesn't sign this extension, and this might be a little more player driven, at least with him, because he'll have the ability to go to Philadelphia. If James Harden has a bad playoffs, then what? Like, I think he's counting on getting a lot of money from the Clippers. But what if he has a James Harden postseason and the Clippers don't feel good about paying him? Then what?
The Cavs with the Mitchell thing, it's kind of a similar mm-hmm. thread to some extent of like, does this change the player's attitude towards the franchise? Using the originally coined by Ethan Sherwood Strauss time to panic thing, I don't think this is going to be the year for the Mavs or the Suns, but there also are a lot of moving parts there, and it wouldn't take much for it to be. I think both of them are going to get another year of grace.
Yeah, I think the Mavericks have played well enough past the trade deadline where as long as nothing crazy happens in the playoffs, they can say, look, we have significantly improved our team. Let's get a full season with this group. We'll feel even better. And the Suns, what else are they going to do? Like, I just don't see what their reasonable pivot could be.
And that's the same thing for me with the Lakers, is like, I don't see what their reasonable pivot is. LeBron can obviously do whatever in the world he wants, but
it won't be based on these next few months, probably.
It doesn't appear that it will be. And like, I mean, I brought up the Cavs as a potential East team, and I agree with you. I think the Wolves are ahead of the Celtics. It's just, and the other big thing with the Celtics is, even if they have the infrastructure in place financially and just from a roster construction standpoint, that it would be imprudent for them to break up this roster. Like, even if you decide you want to trade Jaylen Brown at some point, probably isn't best to do it in the summer of 24.
Yeah. Yes. I'll throw one wild card out there. That's the 76ers. Now, you might say, yeah, Joel Embiid made it through all of this. They're coming up on this cap room, this ability to upgrade. Like, why would he stick it out if not to have this part of it? But players aren't always operating on that timeline the way the team would like them to, the way that from the team perspective would make sense. If they don't do well in the playoffs, even if it's because Joel Embiid is hurt, if he just says, look, this has just been, it hasn't gone well enough here and I'm ready for something different, I think that's at least possible. I don't think that's going to be the case. That's why they're the wild card pick. But if I were the 76ers, I would feel much better if I go into the summer coming off some level of achievement in the postseason for Joel Embiid to feel good about.
Absolutely. 100%. And we could do a whole podcast on this. We're not going to. But the shift in the universe of things that were available to Philly with the spending power. Spending power does not have to be free agents in 24, which they could have pre-spent with trades and everything like that. The difference between what it was a year plus ago, when it kind of seemed like this is where things were going, or not even a year plus, because the Harden situation hadn't fallen apart and then resolved by that point, it to now is really striking. I mean, and there's no guarantee that Siakam, that OG Anunoby, and some of the other guys are going to go. And of course, there could be imbalanced trades. And you are one of the best articulators at how cap space can be used in ways that are not free agents. But it's the idea that, like, that I had had of, like, oh, they're the two seed in the East and they're going to convince somebody to come. It's like, well, who is that even now?
James Harden? I don't know.
I was going to say, is there a funnier result? But yeah, there are funnier results. There just aren't that many.
Yeah, I don't know if there are any funnier. That's the problem with cap space, is that there aren't always the free agents. Paul George is the home run for them. And after that, I don't know.
But the good news for the Sixers is that there are a lot of different ways that they can add players and improve. It's just that there isn't somebody like... Cap space and free agency is so difficult because there isn't that much surplus value out there in the first place. And I think that's one of the underappreciated parts of it, is that other than max players and to an extent minimum players, there just aren't that many ways, because the whole point of it is to at least get close to properly valuing guys.
All right, I'm going to push back on that a little bit. Okay. It's nice to get value. If you're the 76ers, when healthy, you're a really good team. You just need good players. They're at the point, I'd rather overpay to get the best players rather than get the best value.
Agreed on that part. But what I'm saying is, it's just, it's hard. Like, you don't usually, like, for example, you could think about the teams that have kind of built out and, like, really their depth, like the best version of the Warriors, or if you want to say, like, OKC now. It's like, they're not doing it through free agency because it's very hard to.
Yes. Okay. Agreed on that.
And so, that said, Daryl Morey calls everyone. He's very creative. He's aggressive. And I firmly believe, I haven't talked to him about this, I don't talk to him about stuff, that they will have some sort of plan. I just have no idea what it is.
Yeah, I mean, I had them in the mock trade deadline. It was very difficult to make guesses of what it could be, because, I mean, the Hield was interesting, I guess. It feels like this is an opportunity to do something big. It seems like they shouldn't, and Morey in particular wouldn't, take half steps that limit your opportunity to do something big when you can, right? You don't want to take a half step now and then be stuck taking another half step later. I think you'd rather just wait to do something big as much as you can, as long as Joel Embiid is going to stay. And to me, because you don't know how long Joel Embiid is going to stay, this is the perfect time from your side to do something big. I just don't know what player is going to want to come in as a free agent, or what team is going to trade with you. Like, I don't know who your partner is in doing something big, other than Paul George. Paul George is the home run.
Paul George is the home run. And one last thing to throw out as a big problem for them. I can't remember if I wrote this as a piece, but I definitely want to if I haven't. That there just aren't that many situations around the league where there are teams that are, like, so desperate to cut salary where they're going to sacrifice a lot of player quality. Because those sorts of moves, there have been some real benefiting teams in the past from that kind of a structure, where it's like, hey, we know this guy's good, but we need to do something. And so, like, fine, we'll get something, and, you know, we'll shave $15 million, or at that time it was usually more like 10, and then the other team gets a really good player. I don't know who that is. Like, I mean, Atlanta would love to shed money. Minnesota might, depending on how everything goes. And there are a few other teams around there, but are they gonna get offload a player for 10 cents on the dollar talent wise to Philly to make it work? It's hard for me to imagine that.
Yeah, it feels like those types of deals haven't happened in a long time.
Exactly.
A combination of teams being smarter, owners probably being richer. Like, sure, the luxury tax line sometimes is probably the only reason now, where in the past, maybe teams just wanted lower payrolls so they didn't have to pay as much. I don't see anybody doing that now.
Can I throw one out there? What I don't think this would be even funnier, but when you consider the history of the player and thing, it might be, is if, like, for some reason Jimmy Butler and the Heat get to an impasse on an extension and then he gets traded to Philly.
That would be interesting. That would certainly be interesting.
I think they could probably do better than what Philly would probably offer, but oh boy, that would be fun.
Sure would.
And I believe Joel and Jimmy are on relatively good terms.
Yeah. I mean, a lot of people have predicted they'll be teammates in Miami.
Yeah, the swirling winds of everyone who wanted Joel Embiid to every other NBA team who wanted Joel Embiid to get traded. That definitely seems like it's in a different place now. For now, where it goes, we don't know. Well, I think that's as good a place as any to stop. I will thank you so much for taking the time to come on.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks again to Dan Feldman for taking the time to come on. You can read his excellent work as a part of Dunked on Prime and the Daily Dunks, and you can also hear it. He does audio versions a fair amount as well. It is so valuable for me, partially because my availability has changed a little bit as a relatively new father, and partially because he does such a good job. Dan is better at sifting through the news that comes in and what matters and what doesn't, and that is valuable all times of the year, but it's especially good right now. I'm excited to see, you know, where everything goes with the Minnesota Timberwolves ownership situation, which we talked about at the beginning and a little bit at the end. And so many other elements of this. And of course, Dan is also a great analyst and does good salary cap work and everything else. You can also follow him on social media if you don't. And if you want to support this show, there are a lot of ways you can do that. You can subscribe, download every episode. That is particularly useful for Real GM Radio because it's never going to come out on a specific day of the week. That's my availability, guest availability, and of course that can vary. You can also help other people find the show, and that is through word of mouth, social media, through leaving a rating and review in the podcast player of your choosing. And if Real GM Radio is not in a podcast player of your choosing, let me know. I appreciate that. I think we're pretty good right now, but if there is something, hey, be good if you're here, I will pass it along the line. That is not something I can fix, but it's something I can have other people fix. And then the most important thing you can do for this podcast and any other that has them is to check out our sponsors for this episode. That is Prize Picks. Download the Prize Picks app today. Use the code CLNS, which tells them that you came from us. But more importantly for you, it gets you a first deposit match up to $100, which is simply fantastic. And you can also check out my other work. The Athletic is where my written stuff goes. Of course, Dunked On and Dunked On Prime. Nate and I have a ton of content coming out right now because not only are we doing gamers and late season analysis and everything else like that, but the end of the season brings a lot of other content as well. That means awards are coming soon. That means we just finished all of our position rankings and top 10 players. So it is a great time to not only subscribe for the postseason run, but also to catch up on some of the content that we spend a lot of time on that you don't always find everywhere else. And we're going to do a lot of fun stuff over the next 2 weeks. And then we actually have the last NBA strategy stream of this regular season. That will be on Monday. It is the Pelicans-Suns game. We're excited to do that one. I believe it is a 8 Eastern, 5 Pacific start. And lots to break down with those two teams, a game with real playoff stakes. And stay tuned. Nate and I will presumably be doing some sort of live content during the playoffs. I don't think it has been announced yet, but keep an ear out for it. And as always, if you have any feedback, good, bad, or indifferent, DannyLaRueNBA@gmail.com is the way to get it to me. If you take the time to write it, I will take the time to read it. That is an absolute promise. I will not always reply, but I will always read. That is what I promise. That is what I do. And that is all for now. So I hope you all have a wonderful weekend or beginning of the week, depending on when you listen to this. Thank you so much for listening. Take care and make it a great day.